This is Dr. Richard Verone. I am conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Winston S. Churchill III. I am joined today by Assistant Archivist and Oral Historian Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive also. We are, the three of us, are in the Rawls Business College Conference Room in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. Today is March 30th, 2005, and it is 11:05 a.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Churchill, thank you for talking with us this morning. We'd like to ask you, if you could, you spent your time in Southeast Asia as a correspondent in 1966. If you could you provide some comments and tell us a little bit about how you got that job and getting into Vietnam? How did that happen?
I had just completed a mammoth coast-to-coast lecture tour of the States, and at a Christmas party in the home of my mother, who later became Pamela Harriman, at the time she was Pamela Haywood, in Mount Kisco, New York, I was accosted by Mike Coles, the publisher of Look magazine at the time, which was the competitor of Life magazine, who said, "Winston, would you care to go to Vietnam for us?" And, you know, it was Mao Chinaman. I was over the moon. I can't say that was the reaction of my wife, who had just produced our first child. Okay. But anyway, so I got myself organized, and I first of all made it my business to go and interview Sir Gerald Templer, who was the British general in charge of confronting and indeed defeating the communist insurgency in Borneo, which today is part of Malaysia, and to try to find out what lessons we had learned in that conflict. And I also went out by way of not just Singapore, which was still in was still a major British base, but I went on to Borneo to see British troops in action at the time of what was known as confrontation between Indonesia and Malaysia at the time. And so, having briefed myself from the British point of view, I then arrived in Saigon, where I arrived, I would imagine, sort of mid-January 1966. And I thought I knew nobody in all of Southeast Asia. I was walking down, the first day of my arrival, I was walking down Tude Street in Saigon, and I suddenly hear my name called. Mm-hmm. And I look across the street, and it's Johnny Apple, better known to people as R.W. Apple Jr., who for many years afterwards was correspondent to the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And he and I had been on the copy desk of the Wall Street Journal, which I had done as a summer job in the summer of 1959. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Winston, come to my place this evening, we're celebrating." I said, "What are we celebrating, Johnny?" And he turned around and showed me the denim seat of his pants, which had two clear holes through it. And he said, "Warzone D0500 hours this morning." And he said, "I didn't have so much as a scratch." Today, I shouldn't be saying this, but he's got such a fat ass that he wouldn't have got away unscathed. But anyway, so I find myself that evening in his apartment, and the beer is flowing freely. And there was some crazy, drunken American Air Force colonel, Irish-American, I forget his name, but he was in charge of all PR for the U.S. Air Force throughout Southeast Asia. And he said, "Say, Winston, what are you planning to do in the month you're going to be in country?" Which was the sort of the jargon of the day. And I was an amateur pilot. I'd learned to fly small airplanes when I'd been at Oxford University. And as soon as I left university, I piloted a single-engine plane all the way around the African continent. And on my way out to the Far East from London. I had been reading in the Sunday Times magazine, the British Sunday Times magazine, of a British correspondent who had got on an airstrike from a U.S. Navy carrier. And I thought, what could be more fun than that, to get my sticky little paws on a fast jet? Sure. And without any malice aforethought, I said to this Air Force colonel, the one thing I want to do while I'm here in Vietnam is to fly a combat mission from a carrier. And he went ballistic. He said, hell, those Navy guys, they don't know how to fly. If you want to fly, come fly with the Air Force. He said, give me a call tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. Well, you know, I knew that wars weren't like that. They weren't done for the sort of convenience of journalists and things like that. At least I imagined that they weren't. And at 11 o'clock, I was still at the PIO office getting my press credentials. And it was probably 11:45 before I got round to calling the colonel. He said, get your ass the hell out here. He said, I've got four F-100Fs lined up on the tarmac ready to roll. And so I found a pedicab driver, paid him double, and he pedaled like crazy through the very heavy Saigon traffic out to Tan Sanut Air Base. And sort of 45 minutes later, there I was, waddling out to this clutch of four F-100Fs, weighed down with parachute and dinghy and survival gear and emergency radio and fishing tackle and dagger, you name it, I had it. And I was greeted by Major John Sersel of Columbus, Ohio, who was my pilot. And he extended a welcoming hand, and he said, say, Mr. Churchill, if we're shot down by the VC, will you be explaining to them that you're only an English round eye, not an American round eye? Or would you care for this, handing me the butt end of a Colt 45? I said, give me that damn thing. And 5 minutes later, we were thundering down the runway, four aircraft in formation. Exciting stuff for someone who'd never been in a fast jet before.
Yes.
With the afterburners flaming, got some great pictures. And he was a super guy, Major Sersel. He let me fly the whole mission, apart from the takeoff, the strike, and the landing.
Wow.
And so we flew northeast to Tuiwa, about 300 nautical miles northeast on the coast, where we rendezvoused with our FAC, with our forward air controller, whom we couldn't see, who was in a little Cessna bird dog at 100 feet over the jungle canopy, and who said, I'm making red smoke now. Your target is 100 yards east, west, or whatever, from the red smoke. And we'd been at 35,000 feet, and we rolled over and put out the speed brakes and came in for the attack. And what I was fascinated to learn of the way the U.S. Air Force was operating, that basically these aircraft, on their way to their mission, were a taxi rank, and would be sent very often to very low priority missions, but at any given moment could be reassigned to a higher priority mission. And on the first of the airstrikes I got on, we stuck with the original one, which was frankly a low priority target. There were some recently dug VC trenches, which the net effect was that we made them a bit bigger.
Yes.
And there was a supposed arms dump in a jungle location, which the forward air controller thought we got a secondary explosion out of, which would indicate that, yes, indeed, it was an arms dump. But I wasn't completely convinced by that. and there was no sign of enemy at that point. And then we came in for three or four passes and dumped our ordnance. And then we were back at 35,000 feet heading back to base and a nice beer. But I still hadn't got on my strike with the on my Phantom strike.
Yes.
Britain had just announced that she was going to buy Phantoms, and that's why I particularly was interested in Phantom strike. So I was pretty pleased with my first strike, but 3 weeks later I found myself in Da Nang, and I thought I'd pull the same stunt with the commanding officer and said, you know, the one thing I'd like to do is get on a Phantom strike. He said, well, we don't actually use Phantoms for in-country missions, and it is forbidden by the Pentagon for us to take media out of country. But he said, tell you what, I'll fix you up on a strike and we'll assign a Phantom to the strike. And so we were three. It was your version of the British Canberra bomber. I think it was the B-58.
Okay.
The Hustler was B-57. I think this was B-58. And there were three of those and one Phantom. And the pilot was Colonel Call Me Pancho Pasqualicho. And anyway, he put me in the cockpit quite a while before because I was in the Bombardier Navigator's seat behind. And I was the only one who could control the Sparrow missiles in the unlikely event that we were jumped by some Vietnamese MiGs. And so they showed me how to bracket the target on the little control box and showed me the fire button. And anyway, we thundered down the runway, the four, the three B-58s and the one Phantom F-4C. And as we rolled down the runway, we were reassigned to a higher priority target. On route to that higher priority target, we were reassigned a second time to an even higher priority target, which was on the Yadrang River between Cambodia and Vietnam. And the information that we were given was that U.S. Special Forces were on one side of the river, an entire Vietnamese division was in the jungle on the other side. And so our boys were having trouble. And our mission was effectively to come in and set the jungle ablaze on the other side of the river. And we had four pods, I think it was totaling 64 two-inch high explosive incendiary rockets, and a pistol, which was the colloquial name of the Gatling gun, slung midships or cigar-like underneath the belly of the aircraft. And we came in wing over, dive down high speed towards the target, which again had been identified by a bird dog aircraft. And we fired two pods, which set the jungle ablaze, back on the stick. Suddenly, I find myself being grabbed by the thighs, the calves, and the stomach by the G-suit as it inflated to force the blood back into one's brain, so that we, and we were pulling between 7 and 8 G, and did a quick bank to the right, quick bank to the left. They told us that we were being, we were taking ground fire from machine guns, but luckily it didn't connect. And then we came around for a second pass for the third and fourth pods. And then we came round for two more passes with the pistol, which sort of just sort of grunted, firing 6,000 rounds a minute. And then we were back on our way to base, and we were cleared to land. And suddenly, Pancho in the front office said, I haven't shown you how this bird performs. I promised to. And now we got rid of the garbage,
right,
which was the ordnance. Right. And he said, he broke off the approach. And we were 1 mile from touchdown. Mm-hmm. Pushes the throttle to the firewall, pulls the nose up, and we were doing climbing barrel rolls up to 40,000 feet.
How was your stomach?
Quite one of the most exciting things I've ever done.
Wow.
And so that was my experience with the U.S. Air Force. I also got on a, also from Da Nang, on a bird dog mission. And there you see a totally different view. You see what looks like hundreds of black ants. But they're not black ants. Mm-hmm. They are actually human beings. Mm-hmm. They are fathers, husbands, brothers, working in the fields, whatever. And I have to say that the power of a fast jet and the power of the ordnance which the fast jet delivers is something that can very easily go to your head, and you can very easily think that you are God Almighty. Mm-hmm. And you see these little black ants and you can just squash them without giving it a second thought. And about 3 years later, my first assignment as a correspondent for the Times of London was to report the Nigeria-Biafra civil war. And day one of my arrival in Biafra, I found myself on the receiving end. And you get a totally different impression of aerial warfare. I mean, I heard a roar overhead. I came out of a thatched roof mud hut. I'd gone to sleep with my jeans on. It was about 6 in the morning. The sun was just coming up. I look up and I see above my head the bomb bay of an Aleutian bomber opening up, and bombs cascading down. They land a quarter of a mile down the street on what turned out to be a maternity clinic in full swing. And it was my very unpleasant task to report that and photograph that, and over the next 10 days I saw 10 deliberate attacks on the civilian population of Biafra, culminating the last day in, I counted, arriving on the scene 3 hours later, more than 350 bodies, all women and children or old men. And you know, that to me put in perspective what I had seen the flip side of,
yes,
in Vietnam. And I did feel that one was totally divorced. I mean, until the moment when either the technology breaks down or they get lucky and manage to shoot you down, in which case, whether it is Israeli pilots in the Middle East or American pilots in Southeast Asia, I mean, the civilians would literally tear people apart. I mean, because they're being struck from the air by this almost unseen, unreachable force which they have no means of striking back at. Mm-hmm. When they have the chance of laying their hands on you, they go wild. And I can well imagine that, you know, not that many of those who were shot down actually were taken prisoner. I know there have been long efforts to locate prisoners of war, and I'm sure that some were taken alive and have not been accounted for, but I'm sure equally that many were just on the spot torn apart. And that was sort of the luck of the draw, because otherwise you're totally insulated from the realities of war, and you end up a couple of hours later in the officer's mess downing an ice-cool lager, and you have no contact with the situation on the ground. Mm-hmm. I also spent time with special forces. I went to Play Coup and Play Me, and I was also in Cameron Bay, went down to the Delta, to Kanto, and a very interesting little hamlet, which was a Catholic hamlet, which was under attack from the Viet Cong at the time. We could actually see the entrenchments of the VC. I also spent a very, very lively 24 hours aboard USS Ranger on Yankee Station. Mm-hmm. And that is so impressive. There were two carriers. Each would operate for 12 hours, and the other 12 hours they would stand down, and there'd be resupply of bombs and ammunition and oil. But the other 12 hours sustained operations, and there was a young man, his name escapes me, a 19-year-old, who was my escorting officer, and his elder brother, age 21, had gone off on the first wave, and he never came back. And, you know, for once I was lost for words. And what do you say to a 19-year-old who has just lost his brother, either KIA or MIA? That was really quite an emotional moment. But the excitement of being on that carrier, and there's a wonderful place, I forget what it's called, just very close to where to the touchdown point. So they're coming in at 150 knots with full reheat, mm-hmm. because a jet engine takes a long time to wind up to full power. And if you wait till you miss the cable until you power up, you fall into the drink, mm-hmm. at the end. And so they come in at not only great speed, but with full power and hit the deck. With such a slam, the whole ship shakes, and there's four arrestor cables, and it catches on one of them. And I found that wonderfully exciting. And I have to say that, and I also had a very lively night in War Zone D. My last night, with lots of incoming mortars and machine gun fire. I was with the Royal Australian Regiment. I went along to the Australian ambassador and said, I'd like to go along with the RAR, mm-hmm. For their operation tomorrow in War Zone D. Operation tomorrow in War Zone D. He said, I can neither confirm or deny. I said, look, come off it. All the bar girls in Saigon have known about this for the last 3 days. And anyway, he was playing dumb. And so I just went that late afternoon to Bien Hoa, which was the helicopter support base. And I went from one helo to the other saying, are you going to the RAR? And about the fifth one, I got lucky. He said, yes, hop aboard. And I arrived. God, they were unhappy about my arrival. First of all, they hadn't been told. Secondly, I had no sleeping bag, I had no rations, I had nothing. And they put me in charge of a captain who was the sort of PR guy. And he and one other very generously shared their evening rations with me. And we had a two-man bivvy, and we had to dig foxholes, and it was rocky and really difficult to do. And we eventually got down this far, and some god-awful Aussie officer say, "Say, that's a mighty fine trench." He said, "I think I'll put a machine gunner in that one." And so we had to start all over again. And we hadn't got very deep. Anyway, when the whiz-bangs started flying in the night, we all sort of dove into this trench, and I found myself top of the pile, this much off the ground. So I realized that was a mug's game. So I actually just stayed where I was, lying on the ground. And then at dawn, it was incredible. The sun comes up, not a cloud in the sky, and I'm rubbing my eyes and looking to the sky, and I suddenly see like a great shoal of silver fish. And these were the B-52s from Guam, and more than a dozen of them. And about 5 minutes later, it was like an earthquake. Their target was 5 miles from where I was standing, a network of underground bunkers. And the whole jungle shook, and even some leaves were flying off the trees. That was very impressive.
Well, I know we're out of time, and I appreciate your time with us, sir, and we'll end the interview for now.